Welcome to the Deep Dive, your essential federal news update for Friday, September 12th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we're taking a really deep, comprehensive look at the whirlwind of actions and activities across the U.S. federal government, pretty much everything since the start of September 10th.
Yeah, it's been an incredibly busy few days.
It really has. And our mission here is to try and cut through all that noise for you.
Think of this as, well, your shortcut to understanding not just what happened, but really getting into the granular detail of its impact, its implications.
We'll try to connect the dots for you across the executive, legislative, and judicial branches.
Because as we'll see, none of this stuff happens in a vacuum, right? It's all interconnected.
Exactly.
Hopefully, you'll walk away with a truly informed perspective on, you know, the shifting landscape of American governance. Really grasp the deeper forces at play here.
Okay, let's start with the executive branch. Since September 10th, we've really witnessed a concentrated period of pretty decisive actions, mostly through presidential orders.
Yeah, lots of executive orders dropping.
These moves, they really signal a strategic effort to reshape the U.S. government's posture, kind of centralizing authority within the White House to pursue what looks like a very assertive nationalist agenda, and doing it with minimal reliance on the usual legislative processes or even traditional diplomacy.
It's a clear statement of intent, definitely playing out in real time.
Yeah.
What's striking here, I think, is how these actions aren't just implementing policy that already exists. They're actively creating new political, even legal realities.
Right. They force others to react.
Exactly. They compel other governmental actors, international actors too, to respond. It's a fundamental reorientation, really, of federal power.
So the executive is setting the pace.
Pretty much. Setting the pace and the terms of engagement across a whole range of issues rather than just, you know, reacting to things.
Okay, so let's dive into one of the big ones. Confronting what the administration calls hostage diplomacy. This came through Executive Order 14348.
Right, titled, Strengthening Efforts to Protect U.S. Nationals from Wrongful Detention Abroad.
Signed back on September 5th, but it was officially published, put out there, on September 10th, so it's formally on the books now. And its core function, basically, is to establish this potent new tool aimed at addressing this hostage diplomacy issue and protecting U.S. nationals.
Yeah, and what's really noteworthy here is how this designation, this whole framework, is explicitly modeled on the state sponsor of terrorism list.
Okay, that's a heavy comparison. What does that mean practically?
Well, it's critical because that existing framework, the terrorism one, it comes with a really formidable toolbox of punitive measures.
Ah, so they're adapting that toolbox.
Exactly, adapting it for wrongful detention. So these measures include things like sweeping economic sanctions under IEPA.
IEPA. That's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, right? Gives the president broad powers in emergencies.
That's the one. It also includes visa and travel restrictions, and these can be applied really broadly to a designated country's nationals.
So potentially affecting a lot of people.
Potentially, yes. Plus suspension of U.S. foreign assistance and pretty stringent controls on exports.
Wow.
And the scope is incredibly broad, too. It doesn't just apply to recognized foreign governments. It can also hit any non-state entity that's exercising de facto control over a territory.
So think rebel groups, militias.
Could be. Anywhere holding U.S. citizens who isn't a formal state actor.
So what's the practical consequence of this for, you know, for us, for the listener?
Well, this order creates a formal unilateral framework. The U.S. deciding on its own how to punish countries involved in this hostage diplomacy.
And it's directly targeting specific countries.
The administration has cited nations like Russia, China, Iran as potential designees. So yeah, it seems aimed squarely at them.
It's a pretty powerful statement then. The U.S. isn't just going to negotiate anymore. It's going to actively penalize countries.
That seems to be the message. Now, reactions have been varied. You have former detainees like Paul Whelan who've praised it, called it a powerful deterrent if truly enforced.
But there are concerns, too.
Absolutely. Concerns about the potential for sort of collective punishment of diaspora communities through those broad travel and visa restrictions.
Right, punishing ordinary people for their government's actions.
That's the worry. But the deeper insight here, I think, is how this administration is kind of unilaterally rewriting diplomatic norms, shifting from negotiation first to penalty first.
A more confrontational playbook.
Exactly. More confrontational. And it risks escalating things rather than resolving future detentions. It forces other nations to adapt to this much more aggressive U.S. posture.
And this sets the stage for future conflict, potentially.
It definitely sets the stage for one of the key battles ahead.
Yeah.
The actual designation of countries under this new EO.
Because that could really escalate things.
Dramatically escalate international tensions, yeah. Redefine certain diplomatic relationships. And, you know, impact the lives of citizens living abroad, too.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Still in the executive branch, let's talk trade. The administration has also been busy refining its signature trade policy.
The reciprocal tariffs, yeah.
Right. Institutionalizing the system as both, well, a punitive measure and a negotiating tool.
Mm-hmm. A bit of stick, a bit of carrot.
All while its actual legal foundation is facing a huge test before the Supreme Court. So high stakes all around.
Very high stakes.
The key action here is another executive order, 14346, modifying the scope of reciprocal tariffs and establishing procedures for implementing trade and security agreements.
Also signed September 5th, published September 10th. And it's a complex one.
It really is. It amends that sweeping global tariff regime they first set up back in April 2025.
Right. EO-14257.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one that declared the U.S. trade deficit a national emergency, again, using IEEPA.
So what does this new order, 14346, actually change?
Well, it makes several key modifications to the earlier policies.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, it adjusts the list of goods that are exempt from these reciprocal tariffs. That's an annex too.
Okay. So things moving on and off the list.
Exactly. It adds things like bullion-related articles, certain critical minerals, back onto the exemption list, recognizing maybe their strategic importance or market dynamics.
Makes sense.
But simultaneously, it removes other things from the exemption list, like specific aluminum hydroxide and silicone products.
Yeah.
So those are now newly subject to tariffs.
So it's fine-tuning the targets.
It suggests a very deliberate, ongoing reevaluation of which goods get hit or spared. But the most significant part, really, is the creation of a new annex.
Oh.
It's called the Potential Tariff Adjustments for Aligned Partners, Annex, or PTAP for short.
PTAP. Got it. What's in there?
This annex lists categories of products, things like certain aircraft parts, generic pharmaceuticals, natural resources we don't really have here in the U.S.
Things we might need or want to get easily.
Right. And for these products listed in PTAP, the president may be willing to reduce the reciprocal tariff down to zero.
Okay, so a potential break for trading partners. But there's a catch, I assume.
Oh, definitely a catch. This reduction isn't a freebie. It's explicitly contingent upon that trading partner concluding a specific type of agreement with the U.S.
What kind of agreement?
A trade and security agreement. One that, in the administration's judgment, helps mitigate the national emergency relating to the trade deficit.
Ah, so it ties trade relief directly to security cooperation and addressing that deficit emergency.
Precisely. It's a very specific quid pro quo. It's designed to leverage trade policy to achieve these broader national security and economic goals, all under that umbrella of the declared national emergency.
So how does this policy actually work in practice then? What does it mean for how we deal with other countries?
Well, like you said earlier, it's not just a punitive tariff system anymore. It's really a strategic evolution.
Moving beyond just punishment.
Right. It transitions the policy from purely punitive to more of a carrot and stick approach, the continued threat of high tariffs. That's the stick to get partners to the negotiating table.
And the carrot.
The promise of exemptions, zero tariffs, for those goods listed in the PTAP annex. That's the incentive for finalizing deals the administration sees as favorable.
So it institutionalizes a very transactional, president-led trade policy.
Highly transactional.
Yeah.
And it operates largely outside of the traditional frameworks, you know, Congress, international bodies like the WTO. It really lets the executive drive trade negotiations directly.
Now, you mentioned the economic analysis paints a stark picture. How would the administration likely respond to that? They must argue there's a long-term benefit, right?
So, absolutely. They'd likely argue the short-term costs, which are significant, are a necessary price for achieving long-term strategic independence, rebalancing the global economy, bringing jobs back, that sort of thing.
So how do we, or how should you, weigh that declared long-term vision against these immediate, very real impacts on households?
It's a critical balancing act, and frankly, the economic consequences we're seeing are significant and very broad-reaching.
Let's get into those numbers.
Okay. Independent analyses, places like Penn Wharton, Yale Budget Lab, Fitch Ratings, they all show the average effective U.S. tariff rate has surged. It's at its highest level in nearly a century.
Wow, a century.
Yeah. Estimates vary a bit, but we're talking ranges like Penn Wharton's 9.14% back in June, Yale Budget Lab hit 18.6% last month, Fitch Ratings said 16% this week. These aren't small tweaks. It's a fundamental shift.
And for you, the listener, what does that translate to?
It translates directly into a palpable impact on your wallet. These tariffs are forecast to increment the overall consumer price level by somewhere between 1.8% and 2.3%.
Okay, what does that mean in dollars?
It translates to an annual loss of purchasing power between $2,400 and $3,800 for the average American household.
So for an average family, that's like adding another mortgage payment or a huge chunk of rent for the year, just from tariffs.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. It's a significant hit. And certain sectors, think apparel, shoes, they're expected to see really sharp price rises, straining budgets even more.
And the broader economy, yeah. GDP, inflation.
Projections also show a reduction in real GDP growth, somewhere between 0.5 and 0.9 percentage points shaved off in 2025. And the long-term outlook suggests a permanently smaller U.S. economy.
Smaller economy overall.
Yeah. GDP is now expected to grow maybe 1.4% this year, down from earlier predictions around 1.9%, and inflation set to rise to 3.1% this year, maybe 2.4% next year. So slower growth, higher prices.
What about the government side? Are the tariffs bringing in a lot of revenue?
They are projected to raise a lot, actually, between $2.7 trillion and $3.1 trillion for the Treasury over the next decade.
That sounds like a huge amount.
It is, but those gains are partly offset by the reduced economic growth we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you have the massive GOP tax cuts, mm-hmm. which are set to add about $3.4 trillion to the national deficit over the same period.
So a complex fiscal picture. Tariffs bring money in, but tax cuts add more to the deficit and the economy slows down.
Exactly. It's not a simple equation. Just look at August customs duties. They hit $30 billion. That's three times what they were before this new trade regime kicked in.
And what about the dollar? Tariffs are supposed to boost the currency, right?
Theoretically, yes, by making imports more expensive and domestic goods seem cheaper. But interestingly, the DXY dollar index is actually down about 11% since the beginning of the year.
That's counterintuitive.
It has flummoxed economists, frankly. And hovering over all of this economic strategy is that contested legal foundation.
Right. The Supreme Court case.
Yes. The court agreeing to rule on whether IEPA can even be used for these tariffs creates profound economic uncertainty.
And the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, he warned about this.
He did. He warned that if the court rules against the administration, the Treasury could be compelled to refund up to $1 trillion in already collected tariffs.
$1 trillion.
The disruption would be massive to the budget, to the economy. So this upcoming Supreme Court ruling is absolutely critical. It will truly define the future of U.S. trade policy and presidential power in this area.
Okay, moving beyond trade and foreign policy, the administration has also turned its executive authority inward. We're seeing initiatives to reshape local law enforcement practices and also to harden the nation's immigration enforcement posture.
Yeah, a real focus on domestic issues too, using that executive power, often leading to clashes with local authorities.
Let's start with cashless bail. The White House has issued executive orders specifically aimed at compelling jurisdictions to end cashless bail policies.
Mm-hmm. With a particular focus on the District of Columbia.
Right. This seems like a direct challenge to local criminal justice reforms, some of which have been around for a long time.
Decades, in D.C.'s case. These directives, they instruct federal agencies to basically go find all the federal funding streams that could potentially be suspended or terminated for places that have eliminated cash bail.
So using the power of the purse.
Exactly. It's a powerful lever for the federal government. And furthermore, they've directed the U.S. Attorney General to review the policies of the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department.
To look for what, specifically?
To identify any practices that might result in the pretrial release of defendants the feds deem a threat to public safety, essentially trying to align local practices with federal priorities, even if they clash with local policy choices.
So this represents a really direct federal intervention into local criminal justice policy, using federal funding leverage to influence practices that, as you said, have been in place in D.C. for three decades.
It's a clear move to centralize control over what's traditionally been a local matter. And yeah, it's already sparking significant friction, as you can imagine.
Also on the domestic front, immigration enforcement. On September 10th, news broke about a new class of special agents.
Right, within USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
And these agents will be granted the power to make arrests and even use deadly force against immigrants.
That's what's reported, yes. It's a really significant shift for USCIS, which historically has focused much more on administrative tasks, you know, processing applications, benefits.
Like citizenship or green cards.
Exactly. So this is a substantial expansion of enforcement authority within that agency. It functionally blurs the line between benefits administration and interior law enforcement.
Creating a more aggressive posture.
Much more aggressive. And when you combine this with earlier policies like the extreme vetting order, it really signals a more militarized approach to immigration enforcement overall.
And this approach is being challenged in court too, right?
Simultaneously being litigated, yes.
Yeah.
It's an interesting evolution, or maybe a reversal, of traditional agency roles. And it has profound implications for immigrants and the communities where they live.
And we saw the immediate and frankly tragic implications of this hardened enforcement just this Friday, September 12th. An incident in Chicago.
Yeah, that was very serious. An immigrant was killed,
yeah,
and an ICE officer, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was injured during an enforcement operation.
What happened exactly?
According to reports, ICE officers conduct a traffic stop to detain a man named Silverio Villegas Gonzalez. He allegedly resisted arrest, dragged an ICE officer with his car for what they called a significant distance.
And the officer responded.
The officer opened fire, fatally shooting the immigrant.
How did DHS respond?
DHS Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin put out a statement saying the officer followed his training, used appropriate force, and properly enforced the law.
So defending the officer's actions.
Fully. She also criticized what she called viral social media videos and activists encouraging illegal aliens to resist law enforcement, blaming them for undermining public safety and potentially escalating situations like this.
And Villegas Gonzalez.
DHS described him as a criminal illegal immigrant with a history of reckless driving. This whole incident was part of something called Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago.
A broader enforcement campaign.
Seems so. Highlighting this ongoing federal push.
Unsurprisingly, this sparked strong opposition locally in Illinois.
Yeah, immediate backlash. Illinois House Speaker Emmanuel Chris Welch called it an avoidable tragedy.
And State Representative Norma Hernandez.
She decried ICE's tactics as lawlessness. Immigration advocates are already ramping up local community trainings, trying to prevent similar adverse interactions.
So it really highlights that growing divide between federal enforcement priorities and local concerns and the impact on community trust.
Absolutely.
And this wasn't the only major enforcement action recently. Earlier on September 4th, there was a large raid in Georgia.
Right, at a Hyundai LG Energy Solution battery plant. Nearly 500 workers were detained.
Including a large number of foreign nationals.
Yes, about 300 South Korean nationals among them. The scale was huge. And in a pretty telling diplomatic move, South Korea actually sent a chartered Boeing 747-8i on September 10th just to collect its nationals.
Wow, sending a jumbo jet. That highlights the international repercussions of these domestic enforcement actions, doesn't it?
It really does. These workers, some apparently on lapsed visas, were reportedly shackled and handcuffed while they were building this $7.6 billion factory.
A huge project with major economic implications.
For both the U.S. and its foreign partners, yes. Officials are now saying the project could be delayed by 3 to 4 months because of this disruption.
And South Korea's reaction.
Their presidential chief of staff, Kang Hoon-sik, noted this points to a kind of new normal in dealing with the U.S.
A new normal? Meaning what?
Requiring constant deal-making, he said, on issues that go beyond just terrorists now, extending into security concerns, like the treatment of their nationals.
So it suggests a real reevaluation of the broader U.S.-South Korea relationship.
It seems so. Moving beyond just economic ties, recognizing the far-reaching impact of U.S. domestic immigration enforcement.
It's fascinating how these domestic policies aren't just internal.
Exactly. They're fueling local versus federal tensions and directly impacting international diplomacy, forcing countries like South Korea to fundamentally reassess their relationship with the U.S. in ways that go well beyond traditional alliances.
Okay, let's shift to another major event from this week, the aftermath of the assassination of conservative political commentator Charlie Kirk on Wednesday, September 10th.
A shocking event that quickly dominated the news cycle.
In the wake of that, the president engaged in a series of very public acts of mourning, but they also carried strong political undertones.
Mm-hmm. It became a focal point for political maneuvering almost immediately.
On September 10th, the president ordered all American flags lowered to half-mast. That's a rare honor, usually reserved for major public figures or tragedies.
Very rare for a commentator.
The next day, September 11th, he delivered formal remarks honoring Kirk. He announced he'd posthumously award him the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
The nation's highest civilian honor.
And he attended the 9/11 memorial events at the Pentagon, alongside the First Lady and the Secretary of War. Then on Friday, September 12th, the White House announced a suspect was in custody.
Right. Utah Governor Spencer Cox revealed details. 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, arrested on suspicion of aggravated murder, felony firearm discharge, obstruction of justice, held without bail.
And there were some strange details about bullet casings found at the scene.
Yes. Reports mentioned specific engravings on the casings, including things like "Hey Fascist," "Catch," and apparently even, if you read this, "You Are Gay" limo. Bizarre and disturbing details.
How has the administration framed this politically?
Well, the president's response has effectively elevated Kirk to the status of a national martyr.
By tying it to 9/11.
Exactly. By deliberately intertwining the mourning for Kirk with a solemn commemoration of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the administration has politically framed the assassination as an attack on core American values, basically on par with an act of terrorism.
That's a potent linkage.
Very potent. It serves to rally the president's political base, it intensifies partisan divisions, and it provides justification for that hardline law and order posture we've been talking about.
And the timing of other comments reinforced this.
It seemed coordinated. The White House press secretary on September 10th, the same day flags were lowered for Kirk, made comments sharply criticizing crime rates in Democrat cities. It seemed clearly aimed at drawing a partisan line and reinforcing that narrative.
The response wasn't just from the White House either, right? The military leadership weighed in.
Yes. The defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, now using the title Secretary of War, following that recent executive order we'll get to, warned civilian and military employees.
Warned them about what?
That the Pentagon is tracking any comments from them that celebrate or mock Kirk's assassination, stating zero tolerance.
Strong words. And the Navy secretary, too.
John Phelan, yeah. Cautioned sailors, Marines, and civilians against posts that would discredit the department, emphasizing strict adherence to official conduct, even on social media, even with strong personal opinions.
What about the FBI director? Kash Patel knew Kirk personally, didn't he?
He did. And he's taken significant heat for how he handled the manhunt. There was an early tweet on the night of the assassination indicating a suspect was in custody before it was officially confirmed.
That caused some backlash.
Yes, even from within the IGA movement. Figures like Chris Rufo, Steve Bannon openly questioned his operational expertise, his candor, suggesting some internal dissatisfaction there.
And there was something about his sign-off.
Yeah, his tweet apparently signed off with a reference to Valhalla, which sparked a lot of online speculation and commentary, added another layer of weirdness to it all.
So what's the bigger picture here?
What's really insightful, I think, is how a tragic individual event like this can be so rapidly leveraged by an administration to shape a political narrative, intensify partisan divisions, even justify a harder line on law enforcement and national security, essentially turning a personal tragedy into a broad political and ideological rallying cry.
Okay, beyond those major policy shifts and the Kirk aftermath, there were also a series of other executive actions this week, reflecting broader administrative priorities, maybe.
Yeah, a mix of things, from symbolic rebrands to regulatory rollbacks, even some contentious health policy decisions.
Let's start with that rebranding. Executive Order 14347, restoring the United States Department of War.
Signed September 5th, published September 10th.
This authorizes the Department of Defense and its officials to use Department of War and Secretary of War as secondary titles and directs a plan for a permanent name change.
That's right. It's largely symbolic, of course. The actual functions don't change overnight. But the aim seems to be to fortify the image of an incredibly strong American military machine.
Based on what logic?
The underlying logic seems to be a militarily strong U.S. means peace will prevail. It's a rebrand to convey an image of unwavering American supremacy on the global stage, projecting power, deterring adversaries.
So more than just a name change.
I think what's truly insightful isn't just the symbolic show of force. It's how this rebrand, in its simplicity, deliberately reframes the national conversation. It pushes away from nuanced defense strategies towards a more binary war versus peace mentality.
Which could potentially.
Potentially pave the way for public acceptance of more aggressive foreign policy actions, maybe fewer diplomatic solutions sought.
And interestingly, this newly retitled War Department faces an immediate test, doesn't it?
Yeah, its first big test in the Far East, following that Victory Day parade in Beijing that featured Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and Kim Jong-un together.
That image certainly drew some lines in East Asia.
Sharply drawn lines, yeah. Creating a clear geopolitical challenge for the U.S. in this newly defined global context.
Okay, shifting from the symbolic to the substantive environmental regulations, the administration took significant steps here, too.
Yes, on Friday, September 12th, the EPA Environmental Protection Agency announced it's proposing to repeal requirements under a 2009 rule.
Which rule is that?
The one that forced major emitters of planet-warming gases to report their greenhouse gas emissions. It typically applied to facilities releasing the equivalent of at least 25,000 metric tons of CO2.
So, getting rid of mandatory reporting for big polluters.
That's the proposal. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin stated the program is nothing more than bureaucratic red tape that does nothing to improve air quality. He argued it costs businesses billions, drives up living costs.
And if this goes through?
The administration says if finalized, no industries will be required to submit their 2025 emissions data. So, a complete rollback of this reporting requirement, it's a departure from a key mechanism for climate accountability.
What are critics saying?
Well, people like Joseph Goffman, who used to lead EPA's Air and Radiation Office under Biden, argue that by hiding this information from the public, Administrator Zeldin is denying Americans the ability to see the damaging results of his actions.
On climate pollution, air quality, public health.
Right. He called it a deliberate blockade against future action on climate change, highlighting concerns about transparency and environmental policy that go way beyond just air quality metrics.
And this fits a pattern.
Definitely. It follows several other moves by this administration to cut back climate regulations, including a proposed repeal of the finding that climate change even poses a threat to the public, plus proposed repeals of climate rules for cars, power plants.
So a consistent effort to dismantle regulations they see as burdensome.
Exactly, viewing them primarily as economic burdens rather than environmental or health safeguards.
Okay, from environmental policy to a really contentious social issue, reproductive rights. Planned Parenthood led a group urging action this week.
Yes, on Friday, September 12th. More than 70 reproductive rights groups sent a letter to Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
Asking him to do what?
To call off the planned destruction of about $10 million worth of usable birth control products.
Destruction? Why are they planning to destroy them?
Well, these supplies were bought by USAID before the Trump administration dismantled that agency and cut international family planning programs earlier this year.
So the supplies are just sitting somewhere?
In a warehouse in Belgium, apparently. They're still usable, not set to expire until at least 2027. But the administration has refused multiple offers from groups wanting to purchase them.
And instead, they're paying to destroy them.
They've committed $167,000 to incinerate them in France, which raises questions about the financial logic, let alone the humanitarian side.
There was some confusion about whether they had already been destroyed.
Yeah, the New York Times reported Thursday they had been destroyed. But then USAID retracted that statement after Belgian officials said, nope, they haven't been incinerated yet.
So uncertainty and lack of clear communication, what's the administration's rationale?
A State Department spokesperson told The Hill back in August that the agency made a preliminary decision to destroy abortifacients in the supplies.
Abortifacients, meaning drugs that induce abortion.
That's the term they used. However, nonprofits and other sources strongly contend there are no abortion-inducing products in this stockpile, just standard contraceptives.
So it raises questions about whether the decision is based on accurate medical information or something else.
Or on ideological interpretations, yeah.
And the potential impact if these are destroyed.
Opponents highlight it could leave 1.4 million women and girls across Africa without access to life-saving care. They're calling it a cruel and wasteful decision, underscoring the significant humanitarian impact and global health implications.
All right, let's move to public health and scientific integrity, a controversial move from the CDC this week.
Yes, on Thursday, September 11th, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, posted a notice of intent.
For what?
To award a sole source fixed price contract to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI.
To study what?
To examine the association between vaccinations and autism prevalence.
Wait, the vaccine autism link? Hasn't that been widely debunked by numerous large studies?
It has, yes. The overwhelming scientific consensus is there's no link. However, the current HHS secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has consistently promoted the possibility of such a link for years.
And he promised a federal report on autism causes.
Promised one for later this month. Although, interestingly, FDA Commissioner Marty Makary stated HHS hasn't even started writing it yet.
So maybe some internal inconsistencies or lack of coordination there within the administration's health agencies.
It's possible.
Why RPI for the study?
The CDC noted RPI has a unique ability to link children to maternal cohorts using proprietary databases and de-identified data sets, suggesting a specific methodology. The director of RPI's Biotech Center, Jürgen Hahn, is known for autism research.
This is happening amidst some turmoil at the CDC, though, isn't it?
Significant turmoil. Following the administration's firing of the former CDC director, Susan Manares, and then subsequent resignations of other top officials, it definitely raises concerns about the future of vaccine policy and research integrity at the federal level.
And it reflects RFK Jr.'s longstanding focus on this issue.
Decades-long promotion of this debunked theory, yeah.
Yeah.
It originated from that retracted 1998 paper by Andrew Wakefield. This signals a potential shift in federal health research priorities, moving away from established scientific consensus.
And related to vaccines, there was pressure on RFK Jr. from Congress.
Yes. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, chairs the relevant Senate committee. He publicly called on RFK Jr. to support the whooping cough vaccine.
Why specifically?
Because Louisiana is experiencing one of its worst outbreaks in recent history. Tragically, two infants died back in April. So direct pressure on the HHS secretary regarding established vital public health measures, even as the administration pursues these other more controversial research avenues.
Okay, turning to national security and legal scrutiny. John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, is under investigation.
Yes, and on Friday, September 12th, court filings offered some more insight into the basis for that FBI investigation.
What did they reveal?
The affidavit, which was initially filed back on August 21st, details that agents believe Bolton might have violated the Espionage Act.
The Espionage Act? How?
By potentially mishandling national defense information while he was drafting his memoir, The Room Where It Happened.
Okay. Anything else significant in the filings?
Yes. 10 pages discussing the hack of Bolton's personal AOL account by a foreign entity were completely redacted, blacked out.
Suggesting high sensitivity.
Definitely indicates sensitivity, mm-hmm. Potential national security implications. The New York Times had previously reported this inquiry included emails Bolton sent while at the White House that were gathered by a foreign intelligence service. So the hack seems central.
What does Bolton's side say?
His attorney, Abby Lowell, stated that these materials were reviewed and the case was closed years ago by the Biden administration.
So why is it back now?
Lowell claims they've been revived because Trump's DOJ, the most politicized in American history, is carrying out his political revenge.
Strong words, accusing political motivation.
Very strong. No charges have been filed yet, of course. And Bolton has been a frequent, sharp critic of Trump's foreign policy since leaving the administration. So it does raise questions about the timing and motivation behind this renewed investigation.
Let's touch on foreign policy alliances. Senator Rick Scott was highlighting the U.S.-Philippines relationship.
Yeah, in a commentary published Thursday, September 11th, this followed his visit to the Philippines earlier in the month.
And he sees that alliance as critical.
Absolutely. He views the Philippines as more than just, you know, an anchor for the U.S. and the Western Pacific. He calls it a vibrant democracy, an unashamed ally that wants stronger ties.
And its location is key.
Essential. Especially for countering the growing influence of communist China in the South China Sea, which is such a critical artery for global trade, underscoring its geopolitical significance.
So Scott emphasized the military partnership.
Said it's more important than ever to counter China's illegal, coercive, and aggressive actions. And economically, too, the Philippines is a major partner. Billions in goods and services exchanged every year.
Florida has strong ties.
He pointed out Florida alone exported about $1.06 billion worth of goods there in 2024. Tangible economic connections.
And politically, are they aligned with the current administration?
Scott argues the Filipino government and President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. are aligned with the U.S. and President Trump, both economically and militarily.
Making the alliance.
A massive roadblock, in Scott's words, to China's desired domination of Southeast Asia. So he sees this alignment as crucial for regional stability and U.S. influence, particularly with those escalating tensions in the South China Sea.
Okay, a slightly different angle on international relations. Actor Sean Penn was reflecting on meeting Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, in an interview on Thursday, September 11th, he reflected on meeting Putin way back in 2001, said he felt conned by him.
Penn's been involved with Ukraine, right?
He made a documentary about the Ukraine war in 2023, and he spoke out about the ongoing conflict, now over 3 years old. He criticized the U.S. for not providing Ukraine with the resources needed to actually defeat Russia.
Pointing to recent events.
Yeah, recent Kremlin strikes on Kyiv, a drone attack that even seeped into Polish territory, forcing NATO leaders to evaluate their response. It highlights the escalating aggression and the continued humanitarian crisis there.
And this comes after President Trump met with Putin recently.
Right. They met in Alaska back in August. Both leaders signaled hope for a ceasefire then.
But the attacks have continued.
Repeated strikes on civilians in Ukraine have continued, yes. So it highlights this really complex, ongoing foreign policy challenge for the administration. And it further contextualizes that Department of War discussion we had earlier and the broader global security environment that just keeps demanding attention.
Okay, finally, under the executive branch, let's look at domestic government operations, specifically the IRS.
Yeah, some significant news there. On Friday, September 12th, the IRS announced a major shift in its hiring plans for customer service employees.
Shifting how?
Moving away from hiring full-time career positions to primarily hiring seasonal workers. And these seasonal hires have fewer job protections.
Is the IRS facing staffing issues?
A crisis, really. Yeah. They've lost over 8,600 taxpayer services employees under the Trump administration. That's about 20% of their total staff in that area. Done through layoffs, voluntary separation incentives.
And that has consequences for taxpayers.
The National Taxpayer Advocate warned Congress back in June that these cuts could lead to significant taxpayer delays next year, impacting millions of people trying to navigate the tax system, get refunds, get help.
So they need more staff, but they're shifting to seasonal hires. How did this unfold?
Well, the agency initially posted 4,500 full-time contact service representative jobs back in July, but then they quickly pulled those postings down.
And now?
Now they're looking to fill over 2,150 frontline positions, but more than 70% of those will be seasonal term appointments. They can't exceed 4 years.
How are employees or unions reacting?
Not well. Matt Hoffman, chief negotiator for the National Treasury Employees Union Chapter 66, called it a bait and switch.
A bait and switch? Why?
He noted that these term appointments greatly limit the employees, their rights, and their confidence. They don't have career tenure, no long-term stability. It creates a sense of precariousness.
Did the IRS get the funding it requested for hiring?
No. They had requested $850 million to hire 11,000 call center reps for fiscal 2026. But the House Appropriations Committee cut those funds. So that exacerbates the staffing crunch and signals a lack of support for the agency's operational needs.
And there's a broader hiring freeze, too.
Yes, a government-wide hiring freeze was extended until October 15th. But the IRS's freeze remains indefinite.
So indefinite freeze, shift to seasonal workers, funding cuts, all while they need to implement major tax code changes.
Exactly. The agency is scrambling to prepare its workforce and its IT systems for the big changes coming from that recently signed Big Beautiful Bill. Some parts go into effect next filing season. It's immense pressure on an already understaffed agency dealing with a very complex transition.
Okay, let's move over to the legislative branch now. Congress during this period, it really seems like a theater of starkly contrasting priorities.
Yeah, it reveals a deep partisan divide, definitely, and also a kind of functional divergence between the House and the Senate.
It's almost like two different shows playing under the same roof.
That's a good way to put it. You see the Republican-led House focusing on this very aggressive assertion of federal power over D.C. local governance, a very specific ideological battleground.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Senate has been consumed by the more traditional, often bipartisan by necessity process of debating the annual defense bill, the NDAA. That requires a different kind of engagement, usually more compromise.
Okay, let's dig into that first one, the battle for the Capitol, congressional intervention in D.C. home rule.
The House has launched what you could call a broad legislative assault on the District of Columbia's economy.
Trying to remake its criminal justice system, curtail local officials' powers.
Exactly. And this effort, it's a direct legislative follow-through on those policy objectives we heard in the president's executive orders about D.C. bail.
So the executive sets the target, the House provides the legislative firepower.
Seems that way. On September 10th, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform held a marathon markup session.
And they advanced a lot of bills.
A package of at least 14 bills aimed at fundamentally overhauling D.C.'s criminal justice system and rolling back its home rule authority. Approved largely along party lines, which really underscores the partisan nature of this whole thing.
14 bills. That's a lot. Can you break down what they aim to do?
It's incredibly sweeping. Several bills target D.C. sentencing and bail laws directly. One, the District of Columbia Cash Bail Reform Act, would mandate pretrial detention for people charged with violent or dangerous offenses.
Effectively ending D.C.'s long-standing practice of not using cash bail.
For 3 decades, yeah. Others would hike mandatory minimum sentences for various crimes. One lowers the age for trying youths as adults from 16 down to 14.
14, wow.
Another reduces the age cap for eligibility for more lenient sentencing from 24 down to 18. and it would also prohibit the D.C. Council itself from changing sentencing laws in the future.
Taking away local legislative power on sentencing.
Exactly. And perhaps two of the most consequential bills would actually abolish D.C.'s Judicial Nomination Commission. That's the body that vets local judges.
And replace it with.
And also remove the city's independently elected attorney general. Both would be replaced by presidential appointees.
So direct federal control over judicial appointments and the top prosecutor.
Yes. Then there's the D.C. Home Rule Improvement Act. This would extend the congressional review period for all D.C. laws from 30 days to 60 days. And critically, it would grant Congress the power to veto specific provisions within D.C. laws without having to reject the whole act.
Like a line item veto, but for Congress over a city's laws.
Essentially, yes. Other bills in the package try to write the president's executive orders into law, things like criminalizing camping on public property, establishing a federal commission to make D.C. safe and beautiful.
Was there anything they agreed on?
One bill got unanimous support, introduced by D.C.'s own delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton. It just modernizes the process for transmitting D.C. laws to Congress, allowing electronic submission. So, an administrative update.
This whole legislative package, it represents the most significant federal intervention in D.C.'s local affairs in over 30 years, right?
Easily. And it's ignited a fierce political and social conflict within the Capitol, touching on really fundamental questions of democracy and self-governance.
How do proponents justify it?
Proponents, mainly the committee Republicans, frame it as a necessary exercise of Congress's constitutional oversight authority. They say it's needed to restore law and order, combat a spike in crime, and reverse what they call progressive soft-on-crime policies enacted by the local government.
So they see it as their duty to step in.
Asserting federal supremacy when they perceive local governance as failing on public safety.
And the opposition from D.C. officials, civil rights groups.
They condemn it, calling it a staggering abuse of the federal government's authority, an unprecedented attack on the autonomy and home rule of the district's 700,000 residents.
They see it as politically motivated.
Argue it's a politically motivated attempt to install an authoritarian regime in the nation's capital, using crime as a pretext to dismantle local democratic governance and impose federal will.
There are racial dimensions to this too, aren't there, given D.C.'s demographics and history?
Deeply laden with social and racial dimensions, yes. The district is a majority-minority city, and the 1973 Home Rule Act that granted it self-governance was a landmark achievement of the civil rights movement.
So stripping that power is seen
by opponents as a modern form of voter suppression, targeting a largely black and brown population. Advocacy groups like the Sentencing Project have warned that the proposed policies, harsher mandatory minimums, trying more kids as adults, are regressive measures.
Regressive how?
Proven to exacerbate racial disparities in the criminal justice system, often without actually improving public safety. So what's truly at stake here isn't just local laws, it's a symbolic battleground over self-governance, federal control, and the rights of citizens in the Capitol.
And this federal intervention is having real-world impacts already. That incident with the man throwing a sandwich.
Right. Sean Charles Dunn. He pleaded not guilty on September 10th to misdemeanor assault. His act became kind of a symbol of local opposition to this federalization of crime fighting.
And this happened right as the administration's D.C. takeover, so to speak, hit the one-month mark.
Exactly. With over 2,300 arrests reported in the district during that month, underscoring the very visible impact these policies are having on the ground.
Okay, let's pivot to the Senate. While the House was focused on D.C., the Senate was dealing with its own set of priorities.
Showing that functional divergence we talked about. Focusing on national defense, nomination battles, its distinct constitutional role.
First, the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA.
Right, the annual defense policy bill. The Senate Armed Services Committee's version authorizes $926 billion for national defense.
That's a huge number. How does it compare to the president's request?
It's an increase of more than $32 billion over the president's budget request. So a substantial boost, signaling a clear priority for military investment from the Senate committee.
Where is that extra money going?
It includes significant funding increases for key strategic priorities, things like shipbuilding, modernizing the nuclear arsenal.
Including things the president didn't ask for.
Notably, yes. It includes funding for the new sea-launched cruise missile nuclear warhead, which was not in the president's original budget request, also funding for advanced missile defense systems.
So a real focus on hard power, strategic competition.
A robust focus, yeah. And it stands in sharp contrast to that House Oversight Committee's agenda, which was much more domestically focused, more ideological. This reflects the Senate's traditional role in addressing global threats, ensuring national security.
So what does this tell you, the listener? Even though both chambers are controlled by the same party right now, their legislative priorities in this period are markedly different.
Reveals that functional divergence. The Senate's engaged in its traditional constitutionally mandated role of providing for the common defense, a process that usually requires at least some bipartisan cooperation, even if it's contentious, to ensure national security.
Yeah.
They often take a broader view than the House.
Another big story in the Senate, trying to speed up confirmations for Trump's nominees.
Yeah, a big procedural fight brewing there. On Thursday evening, September 11th, Senate Republicans took the first steps to change the chamber's rules.
To make it easier to confirm nominees.
Exactly. After last-minute negotiations with Democrats fell apart, the Senate moved forward on this proposed rule change with a 45-53 party line vote.
So, a very partisan move. What would the new rule do?
The proposal would allow the Senate to confirm some of Trump's nominees in big batches, specifically undersecretaries, staff positions across various agencies, several ambassadors too.
In groups of how many?
Groups 48 at a time.
48? That's a lot. But it doesn't apply to everyone.
No, it stops short of speeding up votes on high-level cabinet officials and, crucially, lifetime judicial appointments. It's focused more on that bulk of administrative appointments that often get bogged down.
What's the timeline for this?
Republicans need to go through more procedural steps next week. But if it all goes according to plan, the first tranche of these nominees could be confirmed as soon as next Thursday, September 18th.
So, accelerating the staffing of the administration.
Potentially reducing some longstanding vacancies, yes.
How is this being framed?
Well, Senate Majority Leader John Thune frames it as fixing an unsustainable situation caused by Democratic obstruction, restoring expeditious confirmations.
Well, this isn't happening in a vacuum, is it? There's a history here.
Not at all. This is really just the latest salvo in about a dozen years of gradual changes by both parties, chipping away at the filibuster, making the nominations process more partisan.
And Democrats are warning Republicans.
Yes. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, actually echoing a similar warning Mitch McConnell gave Democrats back in 2013, told Republicans they will come to regret this.
Why?
Schumer argues Trump's nominees are historically bad, and this move gives the president more power to just rubber stamp whoever he wants, undermining the Senate's constitutional role of advise and consent. It's a significant institutional clash over the balance of power.
Did they try to reach a compromise?
They did. Democrats discussed maybe limiting the groups to 15 nominees, shortening debate time. But ultimately, they couldn't agree.
What went wrong?
Senator Brian Schatz said they were achingly close. Republican Senator James Lankford lamented that the Senate is stuck and trust is broken down, really highlighting that deep partisan chasm that prevented a deal and just continues to plague the chamber.
Also in the Senate this week, a vote related to Jeffrey Epstein.
Right. On Wednesday, September 10th, Senate Republicans narrowly voted 51-49 to table, basically kill, an amendment.
What did the amendment propose?
It would have directed the Department of Justice to release all its files related to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
And this came up suddenly.
Chuck Schumer kind of ambushed them with a procedural maneuver to force the vote.
Did this vote reveal divisions within the GOP?
Deep divisions, actually. Conservative Senators Josh Hawley and Rand Paul broke with their leadership. They voted against tabling the amendment.
Why?
They argued for greater transparency. And they noted President Trump himself had previously called for releasing unclassified files. So aligning with a segment of the party base demanding more information, more accountability.
How did GOP leadership react?
Majority Leader Thune was annoyed, called Schumer's move a political stunt, just for political gain, a distraction.
And Schumer's take?
He said he jumped at the chance because he believes it's critical for Americans to learn the full truth about Epstein. And politically, he stated Democrats now have ammunition for the midterms, explicitly framing it as an electoral strategy to hold Republicans accountable on transparency.
This ties back to FBI Director Kash Patel, too, doesn't it?
It does. Patel had previously stoked some Epstein conspiracy theories himself. But then, in a joint DOJ-FBI memo back in July, he stated the agencies would not release more information about the case.
And he's testifying soon.
Scheduled to testify before House and Senate Judiciary Committees next week. He'll likely face tough questions about this, adding more scrutiny to his role and the administration's handling of these files, especially amidst public pressure for transparency.
Another contentious moment in the Senate involved Ashley Babbitt.
Also on Wednesday, September 10th, Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, blocked a measure.
What measure?
One seeking to prevent Ashley Babbitt, the January 6th rioter who was killed inside the Capitol, from receiving military funeral honors.
Who proposed blocking the honors?
Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat from Arizona. He requested unanimous consent for his resolution. He argued Babbitt died trying to tear the country down. Military honors are sacred, emphasizing the symbolic importance and appropriate use of these honors.
And Tuberville objected.
He did. Called it a pathetic attempt to strip away the earned honors of a veteran who deployed 7 times. Underscoring the very different views on how to honor military service in this highly charged political context, really highlighting a deep division on interpreting patriotism, service, and the events of January 6th.
Let's talk about environmental issues within the defense bills. Forever chemicals, PFAS.
Yeah, provisions in both the House and Senate versions of the NDAA are actually reducing restrictions on the Pentagon's use of PFAS.
Reducing restrictions. Despite the known health risks, that seems counterintuitive.
It's generating significant debate. The House version of the bill delays the phase-out of PFAS in military firefighting foam.
Wasn't there a deadline to stop using that?
Yes, previous bills mandated a stop by October 2024. But this new provision allows the military to keep purchasing new foam with these chemicals through 2026 and potentially extend its use even longer until 2028 with waivers.
That's a significant rollback. Was there pushback?
Yes. Some moderate Republicans, Fitzpatrick, Kagan's, Lawler, Lalota, introduced an amendment to repeal this delay, citing the harm to service members. But that amendment didn't make it into the final bill that passed the House committee.
What about the Senate version?
The Senate bill, meanwhile, rescinds prohibitions on the military buying certain items containing PFAS. Things like cookware, carpets, rugs, with two of the most toxic types.
And it lifts a restriction on disposal.
Lifts a restriction on incinerating PFAS, which is a very controversial disposal method due to concerns about air pollution and just spreading these persistent chemicals further into the environment.
So what are the concerns here?
Critics argue these provisions will just exacerbate contamination problems, especially around military bases, drive up cleanup costs for taxpayers, and potentially condemn more defense communities and service members to exposure to these harmful chemicals.
Is anyone trying to fight these changes?
Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen has introduced amendments to counter these rollbacks. So it signals a continued battle over environmental and health protections within the defense budget, really highlighting that tension between perceived military readiness and public health concerns.
Shifting to budget matters, there seems to be some early resistance among congressional Republicans to President Trump's request regarding the government shutdown deadline.
Yeah, that deadline is looming at the end of this month. Trump requested a short-term funding bill, a continuing resolution or CR, that would push the deadline into next year, specifically January.
But Republicans aren't keen on that long a delay.
Not the appropriators, anyway. GOP appropriators in both the House and Senate have been pushing for a shorter stopgap, maybe lasting only through November.
Why shorter?
To keep the pressure on lawmakers to actually finish their annual funding bills and to avoid the potential for a year-long CR, which can really hinder government operations and planning.
Are there specific concerns about a long CR?
Senators Jerry Moran and Mike Rounds expressed concern it could lead to year-long flat funding for federal agencies. That would be particularly damaging, they argue, for the Department of Defense hindering new projects, modernization efforts considered critical.
Is there support for a long CR from anyone?
There's a growing appetite among the party's right flank for a year-long stopgap, precisely because it could reduce government spending overall. So, differing priorities within the Republican Party on fiscal responsibility versus operational needs.
What about Democrats? Are they likely to help pass whatever Republicans come up with?
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has warned Republicans not to expect a repeat of what happened back in March.
What happened then?
Democrats helped pass a GOP-crafted plan to keep the government open. But Schumer's saying the current Republican proposals are not good enough to meet the needs of the American people.
So a harder line from Democrats this time.
Seems like it. Suggesting a harder line in the upcoming funding negotiations, which makes a government shutdown perhaps more likely if a compromise isn't reached quickly.
Let's talk cybersecurity. There's a critical deadline approaching at the end of September.
Yeah, America's cyber defenders are scaring down this deadline. for two real pillars of national cyber defense.
Which are?
The Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, CISA, from 2015.
Yeah.
And the State and Local Cybersecurity Grant Program.
Why is CISA so important?
Well, that 10-year-old legislation really broke down barriers between government and the private sector on cyber threats. It provided liability protections, privacy safeguards, to encourage real-time information sharing during cyber attack.
If it expires.
Without reauthorization, companies will likely hesitate to share threat information. Attacks could go unreported. Intrusions could spread further, faster.
Which is especially critical now.
Especially critical, given that adversaries like China are actively pre-positioning themselves inside the digital networks of our critical infrastructure. We're seeing sophisticated attacks, sometimes called typhoons, targeting dozens of nations, designed to siphon off data intelligence on almost everyone. The stakes really couldn't be higher.
What about the grant program?
The State and Local Cybersecurity Grant Program. It was created to provide $1 billion to state and local governments to shore up their defenses.
Is it having an impact?
It's already funding 839 cybersecurity projects across 33 states. So, tangible impact. Senator Gary Peters highlighted how cost-effective it is. Preventing attacks is way cheaper than cleaning up after them.
Is there bipartisan support for renewing these?
Strong bipartisan support, actually. Sean Plankey, Trump's nominee to lead CISA, the agency, lawmakers from both parties, they all strongly support these programs. It's a rare area of consensus.
Has there been any action?
The House Committee on Homeland Security recently advanced a bipartisan measure to extend CISA's liability protections for another 10 years. But the clock is ticking. Both measures need to be passed into law very soon to maintain our national cyber defenses.
Finally, in the legislative context, there was a commentary piece questioning a specific government contracting approach.
Right. Questioning whether it's time to retire the best in class or BIC government-wide contract regime.
What was the critique? BIC was supposed to streamline procurement, right?
That was the intention. But the article argues the BIC model has actually been highly bureaucratic, cumbersome. It's even led to contract duplication across the BIC portfolio itself, kind of contradicting its goal.
And the quality metrics.
The criteria used to measure contract vehicle quality have always been questionable, the article says, often failing to consider actual contract performance results or whether they deliver the best value for the mission.
So has it worked?
In essence, the argument is it hasn't significantly impacted or reduced the proliferation of contract vehicles across government, suggesting it hasn't really achieved its core objectives and might need a fundamental rethink.
What are the current rules around these contracts?
Currently, federal agencies generally must use existing government-wide contracts if they're designated as required use by the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, unless they get an exception.
And if there isn't a required use one?
Then they should consider using other existing government-wide contracts if a suitable required use one isn't available. It outlines that hierarchy that the BIC regime was supposed to optimize.
Okay, let's broaden out slightly. While Congress tackles federal issues, we're also seeing significant legislative actions at the state level making waves.
Yeah, and often with direct links back to federal policy or national politics, these state-level decisions can have ripple effects nationally.
First up, Missouri redistricting.
Yes. On Friday, September 12th, Missouri Senate Republicans passed a new set of congressional district lines. It's now heading to Governor Mike Kehoe for his signature.
And the political aim here?
This new map aims to create one pickup opportunity for the GOP in the U.S. House ahead of the 2026 midterms.
How?
Specifically by breaking up Representative Emanuel Cleaver's Kansas City district, which is a Democratic stronghold.
Is this part of a bigger strategy?
Seems to be. It follows a similar Republican-led redistricting effort in Texas. Together, the goal appears to be netting up to 6 new GOP House seats next year through these map changes.
Though Democrats might counter elsewhere.
Potentially. Democratic-friendly maps, possibly coming out of California, could negate some of those GOP gains. It illustrates that ongoing nationwide battle over electoral maps and partisan advantage. It never really stops.
How did Democrats react to the Missouri map?
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries slammed it. Called it a mid-decade gerrymandering scheme designed to rig the midterm elections.
And this happened in a special session?
Yes. Missouri Republicans called a special session in late August, reportedly after heavy pressure from the White House, specifically to redraw these House lines.
And the governor added something else to the session.
Governor Kehoe also included legislation to make it harder for citizen-led ballot initiatives in Missouri by raising the signature thresholds,
sparking more opposition,
prompting opponents to launch two efforts: gathering signatures for a referendum to try and install the new maps, and gathering signatures for a separate initiative aimed at protecting the initiative process itself, underscoring the depth of this political fight at the state level.
Sticking with state-level clashes, a rare public disagreement between top Texas Republicans.
Yeah, that was interesting. On Friday, September 12th, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick issued a rare public rebuke of his fellow Republican, Governor Greg Abbott.
Over what?
Over Abbott's recent executive order aimed at regulating the sale of THC products in Texas, highlighting a significant split within the state's dominant party on this rapidly evolving issue.
What did Abbott's executive order do?
Issued on Wednesday, September 10th, it directed state agencies to stop the sale of THC products to minors. This came after state lawmakers failed to agree on restrictions during their regular session.
And Abbott's reasoning?
He emphasized, "Texas will not wait when it comes to protecting children and families," framing it as a necessary measure due to legislative inaction and a perceived public safety issue.
But Lieutenant Governor Patrick disagreed. He thought it didn't go far enough.
Exactly. Patrick fears these limited restrictions could actually pave the way for the full legalization of recreational marijuana, which he strongly opposes.
What were his specific concerns?
He highlighted a lack of restrictions on the sale of synthetic THC products, insufficient limits on where stores selling THC could be located, and the absence of a ban on smokable THC in things like Delta 8 and Delta 10 synthetics. Basically, arguing Abbott's order leaves too many loopholes and doesn't prevent broader legalization.
Shifting to California now, lawmakers there approved a measure related to transgender healthcare data.
Yes, this week they passed Senate Bill 497. It's designed to prevent California health providers from releasing confidential medical records of transgender patients.
Specifically in response to investigations from other states.
Exactly. Investigations related to gender-affirming care happening in states that ban such treatment for minors. The California Senate passed it 30-10 on Wednesday, September 10th, after the state assembly had passed it earlier.
This builds on previous California law.
It builds on a 2022 state law that established California as a state of refuge for transgender people.
So what does this new bill actually require?
It would require law enforcement from other states who are requesting health information about transgender individuals in California to provide a warrant. And it would bar California medical providers from complying with out-of-state requests, including subpoenas, if they relate to gender-affirming care that's legal in California.
So directly trying to field residents and providers from policies in other states.
A direct response, yes. An attempt to counteract policies enacted elsewhere that conflict with California's values and laws.
And this comes after actions from the Federal Justice Department.
Yes. The DOJ announced back in June that it had sent over 20 subpoenas to doctors and clinics involved in performing what it termed transgender medical procedures on children.
But there was pushback in court.
There was. On September 3rd, a federal judge actually blocked one of those Trump administration subpoenas, the one sent to Boston Children's Hospital.
On what grounds?
The judge called the DOJ's investigation improper and motivated only by bad faith. Described it as an ideologically motivated assault on higher education and a violation of medical privacy. Pretty strong language from the judge.
What's the federal policy context here?
President Trump issued an executive order back on January 28th stating the U.S. will rigorously enforce laws banning transition-related care for anyone younger than 19.
Have parts of that order been blocked?
Federal judges have blocked parts of it that threaten hospital funding. However, the Supreme Court ruled back in June that states can ban treatment for minors.
So it creates a really complex legal and political battleground.
Very complex, where state laws like California's clash directly with federal enforcement priorities and laws in other states, all over these deeply personal, sensitive issues. The key insight, I think, is seeing how states are increasingly becoming these battlegrounds for national ideological conflicts. And it forces federal courts to step in and mediate these clashes over jurisdiction, individual rights, medical privacy.
Okay, let's turn now to the judicial branch itself. It's clearly emerged as the critical arena for deciding these high-stakes constitutional battles ignited by the executive and legislative branches.
Absolutely. It feels like a really pivotal moment for the balance of power, with the courts often being positioned to have the final say on major policy directions.
We're seeing pivotal rulings from the Supreme Court, lower federal courts,
directly challenging or, in some cases, affirming the administration's most assertive claims of power. It really positions the judiciary as the ultimate arbiter in defining the limits of federal authority right now. The courts are taking on a central role in shaping policy, especially when the other branches are so deeply in conflict.
Let's start at the top with the Supreme Court's emergency docket, the so-called shadow docket.
Right. And just to be clear for listeners, the shadow docket refers to the court issuing significant rulings through brief, often unsigned orders, usually without the full briefing and oral arguments you see in regular cases.
It's drawn criticism for lack of transparency.
It has. But it allows the court to act very quickly on emergency requests from the government or other parties. And they intervened decisively this way in two really controversial policy areas just recently, with profound implications.
First, immigration enforcement. The stay in Nomen v. Vasquez Prodomo.
Yes, on September 8th. The Supreme Court issued a 6-3 decision granting the Trump administration's emergency request for a stay in that case.
A quick, impactful decision, then.
Immediately changed the landscape of immigration enforcement, particularly in California. What it did was pause a temporary restraining order that had been issued by a lower federal court.
What had the lower court order barred?
It had barred federal immigration agents in the Los Angeles area from conducting investigative stops based solely on a specific combination of four factors.
Which factors were those?
An individual's apparent race or ethnicity, speaking Spanish or English with an accent, their presence in certain locations known for hiring day laborers, or their engagement in certain types of work, like construction or landscaping.
And the lower court saw that combination as potential profiling.
Essentially, yes. As potential racial profiling and a violation of the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures.
But the Supreme Court paused that order. What was their rationale?
Well, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion. He argued the government had a fair prospect of reversal when the case is fully heard on its merits.
Why? What was his reasoning?
He reasoned that under the totality of the circumstances, and he specifically argued that includes the extremely high number of undocumented immigrants in the LA area, that combination of the four prohibited factors could indeed constitute the reasonable suspicion required by the Fourth Amendment to justify an investigative stop.
So context matters in his view.
Context, including the prevalence of undocumented immigrants in the area, becomes part of the totality of the circumstances justifying the stop based on those other factors.
Was there a dissent?
A sharp dissent, yes. From Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by two other justices.
What does she argue?
She argued the majority's decision effectively greenlines racial profiling and that it overturns decades of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence using the emergency docket without full briefing or oral argument, raising serious concerns about due process and the implications for civil liberties. It's a significant point of contention about the court's method and its impact.
So practically, this ruling is a major win for the administration's enforcement agenda.
Huge victory for their aggressive immigration enforcement agenda, yes. It allows ICE and Border Patrol to resume tactics that civil rights groups argue are unconstitutional and discriminatory.
And the social impact.
Well, the decision signals that a majority of the court is highly deferential to the executive branch on immigration enforcement matters. That creates a direct social impact by empowering federal agents. But simultaneously, it generates fear and outrage in Latino and immigrant communities who feel they're being unconstitutionally targeted based just on their appearance, their language, their work.
So the key insight here is
how judicial validation, even temporary validation like a stay, of these enforcement tactics can have profound and immediate social consequences, directly impacting the lives, the freedoms, the sense of security for many people.
Okay, the second big Supreme Court action via the emergency docket, the tariff authority case.
Right. On September 9th, the court announced it would hear a case challenging the fundamental legality of President Trump's sweeping global tariffs.
So, taking up the case for a full review, this elevates the whole trade debate to the highest court.
Setting the stage for a truly landmark ruling, yes.
What's the core legal question they'll decide?
The core question is whether that law, IEEP, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act from 1977, actually grants the president the authority to impose unlimited tariffs on goods from nearly every country in the world just by declaring the national trade deficit an emergency.
So does declaring an emergency unlock unlimited tariff power?
That's the essence of it. It goes right to the heart of presidential power versus congressional authority over trade. Can the executive unilaterally wield such immense economic power based on an emergency declaration?
What had the lower courts ruled?
Lower courts had previously ruled against the administration. They found the president had overstepped his authority.
On what grounds?
They found that IEEPA does not contain a clear and explicit delegation from Congress of its constitutional power to tax, which tariffs essentially are. And they also reasoned that such a broad interpretation of presidential power would violate the major questions doctrine.
Remind us what the major questions doctrine is.
It's a legal principle that basically says for executive actions that have vast economic and political significance, major questions, there needs to be explicit authorization from Congress. Federal agencies or the executive can't just make huge policy calls based on vague or ambiguous language in old statutes. Congress has to clearly say they can do it.
So the lower court said Congress didn't clearly authorize this use of IEEPA for massive tariffs.
Yep.
So this sets the stage for a landmark separation of powers case with huge consequences.
Immense consequences. If the court rules against the administration, like we discussed, the Treasury might have to refund up to $1 trillion in collected tariffs. Massive economic fiscal disruption. And it would dismantle the legal foundation of the president's entire transactional trade strategy.
And if they rule for the administration?
Conversely, that would represent a monumental expansion of presidential power. It would affirm the executive's ability to unilaterally control U.S. trade policy just by invoking emergency powers. This is such a critical battle ahead. It will define the future balance of power between the branches and the scope of presidential authority for potentially decades.
Okay, while the Supreme Court considers those ultimate questions of power, the lower federal courts have also been busy, acting as a more immediate check on the administration's policy agenda.
Yes, serving as a crucial policy battlefield, issuing key injunctions that have, at least temporarily, halted some controversial new rules and provided immediate relief to people affected by them.
Like the pushback on social policy changes related to welfare rules.
Right. On September 10th, the U.S. District Court for the District of Rhode Island granted a preliminary injunction. This was in a case called State of New York et al. v. USDOJ et al.
And it blocked a new Trump administration policy.
Blocked it in the 21 states that were plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
What was the contested policy?
It was issued through a series of agency directives back in July 2025. And it dramatically expanded the definition of a federal public benefit under that 1996 welfare reform law, PRWORA.
PRWORA, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Landmark welfare reform.
That's the one. This reinterpretation by the administration would have required states to start verifying the immigration status of recipients for a whole wide range of social services.
Services that were previously exempt.
Exempt for decades. Things like Head Start, community health centers, food banks, even domestic violence shelters. This new policy could have cut off access for many vulnerable individuals, including U.S. citizen children living in mixed-status families.
But the court blocked it. Why?
The judge found the plaintiff states were likely to succeed when the case is fully argued. Reasoned the administration likely violated the Administrative Procedure Act by failing to follow the proper notice and comment rulemaking procedures when they changed the policy, and also by grossly misreading the underlying statute, PRWORA itself, indicating a legal overreach in trying to unilaterally change this longstanding policy.
So this ruling is a significant legal defeat for the administration's efforts here.
A significant setback for their effort to use administrative reinterpretation to restrict immigrant access to social services, yes. It provides immediate protection for access to essential services for vulnerable populations in those 21 states. And it represents a successful legal counterattack by that coalition of Democratic state attorneys general.
What's the key insight here?
It really shows how lower courts can serve as critical front lines against perceived executive overreach in specific policy areas, providing that crucial check and balance when maybe Congress can't or won't act.
Another lower court ruling involved Harvard University.
Yes. On September 3rd, a federal district court issued a decision blocking the Trump administration from withholding federal research grants from Harvard.
How much money was at stake?
More than $2 billion in federal research grants. A huge amount.
What was the administration's stated reason for withholding the funds?
They justified the funding freeze by citing concerns over alleged anti-Semitism on Harvard's campus.
But the court didn't buy that.
The court determined the government's action was, in fact, unlawful retaliation. Retaliation for Harvard exercising its First Amendment rights.
Including criticizing the administration.
Including public criticism of the administration, yes. The judge described the administration's stated rationale about anti-Semitism as a smokescreen, called the action an ideologically motivated assault on higher education.
And found it violated several laws.
Found it violated the First Amendment, the Administrative Procedure Act, and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. A really powerful indictment of the government's motives and methods in this case.
So what does this case highlight?
It highlights the administration's willingness to potentially leverage the power of federal funding to pressure, maybe even punish, institutions it sees as political adversaries. And it underscores the judiciary's crucial role in policing the constitutional limits of those actions.
And it reflects a broader climate on campuses.
It does, a climate where students often feel caught between new university policies trying to manage protests and these threatening overtones from the Trump administration regarding campus activities.
Right.
We've seen similar tensions at places like UC Berkeley, American University. Free speech, institutional autonomy, they're under increased scrutiny.
Okay, one more court action to mention, this one involving the DOJ suing a private company, Uber.
Yes, on Friday, September 12th, the Department of Justice sued Uber, accusing the ride-hailing giant of discriminating against riders with disabilities.
How allegedly?
By routinely denying service to wheelchair users and also to passengers with service dogs.
What specific allegations did the government make?
They allege drivers frequently refuse ride to blind passengers who have service dogs, often canceling trips, sometimes even charging cancellation fees or bogus cleaning fees. Passengers with wheelchairs have also allegedly been rejected.
And disrespectful behavior, too.
Some passengers reported drivers who insult and demean people with disabilities or ask them inappropriate questions. The DOJ argues this isn't just isolated incidents, but stems from Uber's broader failures to prevent discrimination systemically.
What are they seeking in the lawsuit?
$125 million. To compensate victims and address these alleged systemic issues.
How did Uber respond?
Uber stated it fundamentally disagrees with the allegations. They underscore their clear zero-tolerance policy for confirmed service denials.
And pointed to efforts they do make.
Yeah, mentioned efforts to ensure drivers comply with service animal policies, accessibility laws. Said they invest in technology, training, even a 247 service animal denial hotline, asserting their commitment to accessibility and compliance with federal law.
So what does this case illustrate in our broader context?
Well, even though it's not directly about the administration's specific political agenda, it shows the judiciary's ongoing role in addressing key social issues like disability rights and holding major corporations accountable under federal law, like the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a reminder that the courts remain a constant arena for protecting civil rights. And for you, the listener, it speaks to the ability of federal agencies like the DOJ to advocate for vulnerable populations through the legal system.
Okay, let's try to pull all of this together now. What does this all mean? The actions undertaken by the U.S. federal government just between September 10th and 12th, it reveals a period of incredibly intense and consequential activity.
Across all three branches, yeah. It's truly characterized by a very assertive executive branch, a deeply divided legislature, and a judiciary that's been thrust into the role of ultimate arbiter on fundamental questions of power.
And these aren't just disparate occurrences, are they?
No, I think it's crucial to see them as interconnected components of a broader strategic realignment, really, of American governance.
So what's the overarching theme here? As you look at this whole picture from the last few days, what's the single most significant, maybe even a...
This period really encapsulates a fundamental stress test for American democratic institutions. For the traditional separation of powers.
How so?
You have the executive branch aggressively expanding its authority, using executive orders, broad interpretations of emergency powers in trade, national security, domestic law, really proactively bypassing traditional legislative routes.
While the legislative branch
appears fractured. The House acting almost like a rapid response vehicle for the executive's domestic agenda, particularly on things like D.C., while the Senate engages in that more deliberative, though still very contentious, process of national governance, like the defense bill.
And the judicial.
The judicial branch, from the district courts all the way up to the Supreme Court, has become the primary arena where these profound conflicts over the scope and limits of governmental power are being fought out. It's a system under immense pressure, revealing both its resilience, perhaps, but also its vulnerabilities.
Now, it's easy to see these actions as isolated incidents. We've gone through them one by one. But is there a deeper, maybe even coordinated strategy connecting these seemingly disparate moves across the branches? What are you seeing beneath the surface that ties this all together?
I think if you connect the dots, absolutely. These seemingly separate actions look like highly coordinated elements of a unified political strategy.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Take the president's law and order rhetoric. It's amplified by that very solemn public response to the Kirk assassination. That provides the ideological justification for the legislative assault on D.C. home rule that's being pursued aggressively in the House.
So rhetoric enables legislation. What else?
The administration's aggressive immigration enforcement tactics. They get a green light, effectively, from the Supreme Court's stay in that Noem case, and then they're operationalized on the ground by those newly empowered USCIS agents making arrests.
Okay, I see the connection. And trade policy.
The reciprocal tariff policy, even while it faces that final legal test in the Supreme Court, is already being wielded as a powerful diplomatic tool to coerce foreign nations into those bilateral trade and security deals.
So it demonstrates a very integrated top-down approach.
Highly integrated top-down approach to governance, yeah. Where executive action sets the agenda, and then other institutions, Congress, the courts, are often compelled to react, either by validating those actions or challenging them, usually in court. It feels much more like a carefully orchestrated campaign than just a series of accidents.
So looking forward now, the events of just these past few days have clearly set the stage for several critical confrontations, battles that will likely define the political and legal landscape in the coming months.
Definitely. We can see several key battles ahead. First, I'd say the Supreme Court's tariff ruling.
Why is that number one?
It's arguably the most consequential single event on the horizon. The court's decision on the president's authority under IEP will either validate or completely cripple the administration's entire economic and trade agenda. There are trillions of dollars potentially at stake, and the fundamental balance of power between Congress and the president hangs in the balance.
Okay, huge stakes there. What's second?
Second, the future of D.C. home rule. That package of bills passed by the House Oversight Committee will likely pass the full House, given the Republican majority there.
But their fate in the Senate is less certain.
Much less certain. Procedural rules are different. The filibuster is still a factor for legislation. That will be a crucial test of the Senate's institutional role as a moderating force, and a key battle over the principle of federalism itself. It could lead to a prolonged legislative showdown over the Capitol's autonomy.
And third?
Third, the implementation of sanctions regimes. Specifically, the actual designation of countries under that new state sponsor of wrongful detention executive order.
That will be a major foreign policy test.
Huge. A decision to designate a major power, like China or Russia, that could dramatically escalate international tensions, have far-reaching geopolitical consequences, reshape global alliances, trade relations, significantly impact U.S. diplomatic standing.
So putting it all together, what's the strategic outlook from here? Where are things heading?
Well, the current trajectory seems pretty clear. It's one of increasing centralization of power in the executive branch, escalating partisan conflict, particularly between the House and Senate and within the Senate itself, and a growing reliance on the judiciary to resolve these fundamental questions of governance, questions that maybe were once settled more often through the political process, through compromise.
So what should stakeholders, people listening, be prepared for?
Stakeholders across the public and private sectors really need to prepare for a period of heightened policy volatility, where major shifts in trade, immigration, domestic law can be enacted very rapidly, often by executive decree.
And the main recourse for opposition?
In this environment, the primary recourse seems to be through protracted, often uncertain, legal challenges in the courts. The foundational principles, federalism, the norms of congressional oversight, the established balance of powers, they're all under direct and sustained challenge right now. And the outcomes of these battles, the ones playing out now and the ones coming up, will undoubtedly shape the future of American governance for years to come.
We've unpacked a truly dense and incredibly impactful few days in federal news. Wow. From executive orders reshaping foreign policy and trade, to those intense congressional battles over DC's autonomy and Senate rules, and a judiciary actively stepping in to define the limits of power, it really is a lot to process.
It is. And it raises an important question, I think, for you, the listener, to consider. As these lines between the branches seem to blur, and the pace of executive action accelerates like this, how might the traditional checks and balances evolve in the coming years? What happens to that system we learned about in civics class?
And what role does public engagement play? or media narratives.
Right. What part do you think public engagement and media narratives play in shaping these outcomes? And maybe what responsibility do they bear in how this all unfolds?
Definitely something for you to mull over as you process this week's whirlwind of federal activity. Thanks for diving deep with us.